In the matter of Sergeant First Class Frank Chiafalo versus State of New Jersey, may we please have appearances?
Good afternoon, Your Honor. My name is George Daggett on behalf of Sergeant Chiafalo.
Good afternoon, Justices. My name is Alan Shore. I'm here on behalf of Neyland, New Jersey.
Good afternoon, Your Honor. Stephanie Allen, Assistant Attorney General on behalf of the State of New Jersey.
Welcome, Counsel. Mr. Daggett.
Your Honors, the position of my client is that what he pled and what he proved during this case was a SEPA violation. It is true that in the complaint and throughout the case, we relied heavily on Section C of the 34:19-2, in which we took the position that he objected to and refused to participate in an activity which we claim was fraudulent and or criminal. And the reason we approach the case from that viewpoint is that, as you know from the papers filed, and I'm not going to spend a lot of time with it, this was an event that started out as something the state police were proud of and turned into a situation where, after the Star Ledger became aware of it, it became very critical of the state police. And Sergeant Chiafalo wasn't just a sergeant. He was the person in Totowa Troop E headquarters who was, his responsibility was to maintain the records, to preserve the documents of the state police. And so the Major Centenar, who was in charge of all of the road troopers, and Troop B being primarily road troopers, sent out a memo which said, congratulations to Trooper Ventrella. Now, what had happened was that Trooper Ventrella and the other trooper were fired. The top superior officers in Totowa were all transferred to Trenton, and the state police were embarrassed. So to hone in right now at the moment that the beginning of this took place, my client, Sergeant Major, in charge of the documents, goes to the major and says, have you seen this? Now, there were two documents. Unfortunately, the appellate division centered or focused on one. And the one was a letter from a citizen saying, thank you very much for taking us down the parkway at 100 miles an hour. He didn't say it that way, but that's what happened. What happened was, the Star Ledger got a hold of it, and it changed overnight from, hey, way to go, to you're fired, and the rest of you are all taken out of Totowa. So this document comes in. It's a pat on the back for Trooper Ventrella, and as I said, Sergeant Chiafalo goes to Major Cuomo, who's in charge of Troop B. He's not just in charge of a station, he's in charge of Troop B. And he takes the document and he's told, it doesn't exist. Don't approach me again with it. He says, it does exist. I have it in my hand. and he did not do what he reasonably believed he was being told to do, and that is destroy that document. He kept the document. Now, the appellate division from, and I say this respectfully, I think they focused on the letter from the civilian. They didn't focus on the commendation from the major in charge of this whole area of the state police, which says, congratulations. What was that document? It was potential evidence. It was evidence on behalf of Trooper Ventrella if he says, no, 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 you're not firing me. I'm going to an ALJ. And here's my exhibit. Major Centenar said, congratulations, job well done. But Major Cuomo wanted it destroyed. Reasonable belief by my client.
Mr. Daggett, could you focus us just on the basics to start? Which section or sections of 34:19-3 deserve our focus in this appeal?
It is C, section C.
Which parts of C or what part of C?
C, the amicus goes further than I did in the trial.
So let's start with you.
Okay.
We'll let them speak for themselves.
Okay, thank you. By the way, I'm a nervous wreck, so.
You're doing great.
Okay.
So C2, I think you were referring to in your argument.
C2.
Anything else? Is there any other part of the statutory section 19-3 that you're relying on? Nothing in A, or are you relying on A?
No.
Not A.
That's what my position is.
Understood.
That A requires a law. B, or 2 rather, requires that the conduct be fraudulent or criminal. Now, the appellate division...
So just C2, to make sure that we're all on the same page.
Yes, Your Honor.
That's the only statutory section.
Right, C2.
All right. Why don't you tell us how what occurred here fit within C2, how it was reasonably capable of being believed to be fraudulent or criminal.
Okay. As I said, this document was potentially evidence. It was a destruction of a document that was potentially evidence on behalf of the two troopers who were fired. Also, in the record, my client was brought up on disciplinary charges, and they charged him with keeping an official document of the state police, and the charge was substantiated. So this wasn't a letter from a civilian. This was a document that contradicted the action of the state police. So it's criminal.
Is it your position that it is a crime to destroy an official record that may be relevant to an official proceeding?
Yes. Yes.
And that statute is actually cited by your amicus.
I'm sorry?
That statute cited in the amicus brief.
Yes.
2C28-6.
And before the appellate division, after I got the decision and I said they focused on the wrong document, I filed a motion for reconsideration and it was denied. But I pointed out that this document is evidence. And he was told to destroy it and reasonably believed that it was wrong to do so. And you know, I know it's an objective reasonableness, but you also have to look at what his job was. His job was to preserve these documents, and he's being told, get rid of it. So, Justice, that's the section that I focused on in this trial. That the conduct, and there's two incidents. The first incident is the document. The commendation letter from the major to Trooper Ventrella. That's the first. The second is the falsification of time records by Cuomo.
Mr. Daggett, before you leave the memo that you're relying on, did you raise that in the summary judgment proceeding?
Yes.
Okay, and that was cited to the trial court as well as to the appellate division? The memo.
You mean C2?
No, not C2, but the document that you're relying on.
Yes.
Not the citizen's letter, but the other document.
Yes, and when the appellate division granted the motion for summary judgment, I went back again and said, wait, you got the wrong document. You got the letter from the citizen where you should be dealing with Major Centenar's commendation, which says, congratulations for something we just fired you for.
And it was his job duty, was it not, to manage and disseminate documents that came into that troop station?
That's true.
So he was seeking guidance from his supervisor as to how to handle the document?
No, he was being told by his supervisor to... I'm sorry.
Well, when he first went in and asked for direction, he was asking for guidance, correct?
Right.
And the direction he got was the one that you said.
The direction was, at least he reasonably interpreted, was to destroy the document. Mm-hmm. Don't come back to me again with it. It doesn't exist.
But does that really make sense when the document was electronically logged in already, correct?
It was not doc-tracked.
It was not doc-tracked at that time. It was the memo with the handwritten?
It came by envelope.
Okay. But it was not doc-tracked there, but was it doc-tracked anywhere in the system?
That's what the state wanted the jury to believe. What they said was, this document was in a number of places. That's not true. What was in a number of places was the citizen's letter.
Does it make a difference? Because as long as Cuomo thought it wasn't doc-tracked, as long as he thought that if this document disappeared, it would not reflect bad on the state police. And as long as your client reasonably believed that it would be a violation of law for him to destroy it, does it really make a difference whether it was doc-tracked? As long as he's being retaliated against because he's not doing something that Cuomo told him to do, you still have the same argument, don't you?
Yes.
I understand.
Justice mm-hmm. Patterson's question about it may, or at least that's what I understood.
I know, but
it may be in a number of places, but it was the letter from the citizen that was in a number of places. This document, the commendation, that had no history except in Chiafalo's pocket.
I thought the memo itself, to commend them on a job well done, was in at least two other troop headquarters.
If they made a mistake. They sent it to C.
Okay, so, but I thought that Chiafalo knew that this memo was in at least two other headquarters and had been circulated among others in the state police.
I don't believe that's true, Justice. I think it was sent to Troop C by mistake. They put it in an envelope and mailed it to Troop B. But if opposition and the jury believed it, that this document was the only commendation letter from Major Centenar, and this document is what Major Cuomo wanted destroyed.
Well, apparently, even if it was doc-tracked, apparently Cuomo didn't know that, because why would he be telling your client that it doesn't exist?
No.
If he thought it was actually filed electronically in the system. Right.
I agree with what you said, Justice, but what I'm saying is it wasn't, but you're right. If it was and he was told to destroy it, it's the same thing if he was told to destroy an accident report. It existed, and the mentality in Troop B headquarters was it doesn't exist, and that's where we claim C2 applies.
Anything else you'd like to present?
I'm not nervous anymore.
It shows.
Yeah. If anybody has any questions, I have
other questions? Thank you, Mr. Daggett.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Justices. I'm here on behalf of the National Employment Lawyers Association. We are concerned with the larger picture here, which is an appellate division decision that reached an erroneous conclusion, both based upon erroneous facts that Mr. Daggett has mentioned, but also based upon an erroneous interpretation of the law. The appellate division did not recognize that in a summary judgment motion, the court needs to look at all documents and all facts in the light most favorable to the non-moving party. In this case, it's clear that Mr. Daggett argued on behalf of the plaintiff that there was fraudulent intent, that there was an intent to hide time, that there was an attempt to destroy documents that are protected, that there was an intent to break the law by destroying exculpatory evidence. The defendants argued very hard that that's not true. And the court properly reviewed the documents and the facts in the light most favorable to the non-moving party, and they denied summary judgment. Then there was a trial. And at trial, the court and the jury heard all of the facts and reached the same conclusion, that CEPA had been violated. The appellate division never looked at a moment of the trial, finding that the case should have been thrown out on summary judgment. Now, the problem is twofold here with regard to the appellate division's decision. First of all, the appellate division focused on Part 3 of 34:19-3. That's a catch-all provision that's intended when you don't have something that's fraudulent or criminal, and you don't have something that is in violation of the law. The two cases cited involved Heitzman, where an employee was complaining of a high rate of infectious disease, but couldn't point to any statute that was violated, and Zwaner, where the employee was complaining that the employer had failed to read minutes, but couldn't point to any statute. Here, there are clearly violations of law. The destruction.
What would that be, counsel?
Excuse me?
What would that be that there was a violation?
Well, first of all, destroying exculpatory evidence is criminal. NJSA 2C:28-6.
On its face, the memo itself was not exculpatory or inculpatory. It just said congratulations.
No, as a matter of fact, Your Honor, the memo said congratulations, job well done. Please make sure this goes into his personnel file. Now, if Ventrella
is that the violation of law that it wouldn't have gone into his personnel file?
Well, it was designated to go into his personnel file.
The first part, of course. Job well done. They wouldn't be congratulating him if they didn't think it was a job well done. So the second part is what you're suggesting is a violation of law, that it's supposed to go in his personnel file and it didn't?
Yes, Your Honor. Destroying personnel records violates NJAC 13:92-10.4b. And I set that forth in my brief. So there's two laws. There's one which is that Ventrella would have had exculpatory evidence that he would have brought with him to his departmental hearing. And I believe there were even criminal charges brought showing, wait a second, they thought I was doing a good job. I thought I was doing what they wanted me to do, and my boss, the major, sent me a commendation and asked for it to be put in my personnel file that I did such a good job. How can you now fire me for something that my major thought was so good? That's exculpatory evidence. And destroying that.
You keep on using exculpatory. It doesn't have to be exculpatory. It just has to be destroying evidence that should be available at an official proceeding.
That would absolutely.
The statute that you're quoting doesn't say it has to be exculpatory.
I agree with you, and that's for Part 1. And I had argued that Part 1 is a violation of law. It would certainly be. But in order to make it criminal, I do believe you'd have to
get to the next level of destroying exculpatory evidence.
Or at least that we'd have to be relevant.
Is it criminal?
Is it
a criminal act to if this happened, direct someone to destroy this memo?
Yes, it violates the criminal code to destroy evidence that could be exculpatory.
And it's exculpatory of him in an internal proceeding?
Exculpatory evidence of a crime. I mean, they were accused of engaging in criminal acts. They were intentionally speeding and escorting cars that were speeding on the New Jersey Parkway. That was not only dangerous, it was certainly...
I'm missing something, because it doesn't seem to me that this memo goes to whether or not they did that.
The memo goes to congratulating the officer that led the death race and telling him what a good job he did and directing it to go into his personnel file. Certainly the officer, if he had known about that memo, would have been able to use it in order to defend himself from charges that he violated orders. I was commended for this.
Or it could be, even if it wasn't exculpatory, it could have been used as mitigation for the purpose of discipline in various different ways.
Certainly, which is why it's unlawful to destroy personnel records.
There's also a common law cause of action for spoliation of evidence. By this court.
Well, this court didn't recognize the term spoliation. It recognized fraudulent concealment, and that's part two. Destroying evidence is, in fact, fraudulent concealment, and part two of Section C says that the employee is protected if he complained of something that was criminal or fraudulent. And certainly the destruction of evidence is fraudulent concealment, and that's fraudulent, and that satisfies also part two.
Mr. Shore, should the jury have been told that they need to make findings about whether this is destruction of official records versus destruction of evidence, because I didn't see that in the jury instruction. And do you agree that there are distinct findings that should be made by a jury as to those two different points?
First of all, Your Honor, I must say I did not read the trial record, because the trial was in no way part of this appeal.
Mm-hmm.
The appellate division didn't rule on any part of the trial. Well, I did not review it.
But
if you're asking me this court has held many times that the prima facie case, which is, did he reasonably believe, is something that should be dealt with before you get to the trial. At the trial, you're dealing with the employer's a legitimate non-discriminatory reason for firing and whether or not that's a pretext for retaliation. So
well,
I don't know that that would be a separate jury question.
There was a question here about whether the theory of this being destruction of evidence was something that was made known to the trial court, or if it's something that evolved and was explained perhaps in greater detail and better at the appellate level. So assuming that to be neither here nor there, is it a distinction that is important to be made at the trial level in order to bring a cause of action under C1 or 2 or 1 and 2 with those two distinct findings in mind?
Yes, Your Honor, because it's a necessary part of a prima facie case.
Okay.
Mr. Daggett's complaint, which I have with me, I believe paragraph 14 and 15, talk about the fact that there was evidence destroyed.
Criminal or illegal?
Yes. Mm-hmm. It says it right in there.
Right.
And it says it pretty clearly. This was always a part of the case. This is not, I know that the defendants say that this was something they only thought about later. It's in the original complaint that Mr. Daggett filed. It was always part of the case. The appellate division got it wrong.
I'll read to you a sentence or two from the jury charge and let you comment on it. The judge said this: I charge you that there is a law, rule, or regulation or public policy that closely relates to the conduct about which plaintiff blew the whistle. That law, rule, regulation, or public policy states that the official documents of the state police must not be destroyed and that filing false timesheets or false time records is prohibited.
That's exactly right, because by this time this prima facie case has already been pled, otherwise proven, otherwise you don't get to trial, and it's the trial judge's responsibility to read that law to the jury, and I believe that was completely appropriate.
But that's my point. Did the jury need to be told more specifically that it was a violation to be asked to destroy evidence? And based upon what Justice Albin just read to you from the instruction, it doesn't appear as if the jury was asked to make that finding.
I think that inherent, implicit in that instruction is if the jury believed that he wasn't asked to destroy the evidence, they wouldn't be able to find in his favor. Ultimately, the jury's question is, was there a causation between Mr. Schifalo refusing to destroy the document and the retaliation that was taken against
him? That instruction deals with the second part, the timesheets, not with the first part at all.
No, both. And I should read the next sentence, let me read the next sentence. You need not decide whether a direction to destroy evidence or false timesheets is actually violated any law, rule, regulation, or public policy. The only thing you must decide is whether the plaintiff believed that the wrongful activity about which the plaintiff blew the whistle violated the law, rule, regulation, or public policy that I just described, and if so, whether the plaintiff's belief was reasonable. That's I read the rest just to place everything in context.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Your Honor. I do believe that's an appropriate jury instruction to tell the jury this is what is illegal. The jury still has to decide whether it happened or not. That's the factual question for the jury. Mm-hmm.
Before the court.
Excuse me?
The jury instruction is not before the court.
Nothing that happened at the trial is before the court. I would imagine that if this court reverses, it's going to have to go back to the appellate division, because the appellate division never looked at the trial at all. If it can't go back to the trial level, we need the appellate. We need somebody to take a look at the trial record and determine whether there were mistakes made at trial. In closing, I just again want to focus on the appellate decision, which focused entirely on Part C3, which was never part of this case, was never intended to be part of this case. Cases like Zwaner and Heitzman, which resolve issues regarding employees who can't show a statute or an act of fraud, is not the appropriate way to analyze every SEPA case. And the appellate division decision does just that. They paint with broad strokes that this is the standard that you have to meet in a SEPA case.
Your view is that this case could fall under C1 or C2. But
yes, I know that Mr. Daggett is arguing C2 only, but I believe that he has perfectly pled C1 as well. But the one thing he did not do is plead C3, which was the only criteria that the appellate division looked at, and they erred.
But we... Obviously, you've raised both, but Mr. Daggett is presenting his case as a C2 case.
It's a fine C2 case. There's nothing wrong with it as a C2 case. I'm only pointing out that he could have also brought it as a C1 and an A1 and would have been absolutely fine.
Right, but you're suggesting, obviously, given the fact that the plaintiff has indicated that's the nature of his case, that's the subsection we ought to be focused on.
That is a subsection that Mr. Daggett is focusing on. I'm not suggesting otherwise, but as amicus, I'm just pointing out that this could have been successfully brought as well under A1 and C1.
And you've pivoted your argument so that it focuses on C2 as well, we noticed.
Of course. Yeah.
Other questions, anyone?
No.
Thank you. Ms. Cohen.
May it please the court. As your honors are aware, not every purported misdeed falls within the Conscientious Employee Protection Act. As this court has held on numerous occasions, mere internal disputes over internal policies or minor infractions such as telephone calls or the extensions of lunches are not something that is covered by a SEPA case. Instead, the statute is designed to protect only those employees whose either objections or disclosures fall within the mandate of FEPA, which is illegal or unethical activities. The first critical prima facie element of a FEPA case is the reasonable belief that a law has been violated. This court has held that when a defendant objects as a matter of law that a plaintiff's belief is not reasonable, the trial court must conduct a nexus analysis to determine whether the statute or the complaint of conduct squares with there's a substantial nexus between a complaint of conduct and a relevant rule or public policy. Although an actual violation is not required, the nexus still must be established. As this court recognized in both Juanar and later in Heitzman, a pivotal component of a SEPA case is the plaintiff's identification of a statute or other policy that bears a substantial nexus to his or her claim. Without it, this court has held that the case can be dismissed. The court's focus in this appeal should not be on, as appellant and amicus argue, the type of malfeasance that is brought before the court. Instead, it should be on whether the case is in fact even governed by SEPA. The analytical framework that was set forth by this court in both Juanar and Heisman specifically provides the lower court with the appropriate ability to conduct an objective analysis of whether the case actually is governed by SEPA or it's just an internal workplace dispute. To decide the current appeal, the court has to focus on two questions. One, is the identity of a relevant law, public policy, statute, etc., required for any section of SEPA? And since we're limiting this case, and appellant and amicus have said they're going to admit that it was under C2, does that apply to C2 as well, where the complained of actions are claimed to be fraudulent or criminal? We would urge the court to answer this with an unequivocal yes. And two, is it plaintiff's obligation, as opposed to the trial court's, to identify the relevant law, regulation, or other authority? Again, we urge this court to answer that in the affirmative. A trial court's obligation to make a threshold determination necessarily presupposes that some authority has been brought to the court's attention. Schiaffalo and amicus hope to constrain this court's previous rulings. They seek to limit the cases based on either their factual scenario, such as with Heitzman, the improper public patient care, or claim that the identification of a relevant law or regulation isn't necessary when misdeeds are self-evident. That position isn't legally tenable. It's not legally tenable for the analysis to be limited to certain subsections of 3A or 3C, nor has a satisfactory explanation been provided by the appellant. The reason the framework set forth in Juanar and Heitzman should be applied irrespective of what section is brought is because that is the method by which the court determines whether it is in fact a claim that arises under the mandate of SEPA or is merely an internal policy dispute. Acceptance of the appellant's arguments, in short, Your Honors, would eviscerate the critical nexus analysis this court has previously adopted. Therefore, we request that the court affirm the appellate division's ruling.
Do you think it's just a typical business type of argument when a commanding officer tells a subordinate to destroy evidence that may be relevant to an ongoing investigation?
With respect to that, Justice Albin, the question is the court has to do a nexus analysis. So there was neither on summary judgment nor at trial, depending on what this court here wanted to look at, there was no identification of the ruling law brought to the court's attention. So, for example, and in Heitzman, Your Honor, in Juanar, the plaintiff identified what was considered to be a relevant statute, which was the Labor Management or Relations Disclosure Act, and said that this applied to your case. And this court conducted a deep analysis of, one, you've identified that statute, and two, does it really apply to the claims that you were raising? And found that it was wanting because in Juanar...
Are you... Are you disputing that the destruction of evidence at, that would be relevant in a proceeding by a superior officer to a junior officer whose duty it is to preserve records would not be a violation of either a law or regulation? Are you arguing that?
No, Your Honor, what I'm arguing is that the 2C28-6, which is the criminal code that amicus cites as relevant to this case, says that a person commits a crime in the fourth degree if believing that an official proceeding or investigation is pending or about to be instituted. There was no evidence, either on summary judgment or at trial, that Schifolo believed there was to be a official proceeding or an investigation.
Wait.
Well, think about what was going on around him. People were being fired, transferred in the middle of the day, all of a sudden out of the workplace. I mean, this was a hot situation, was it not? Did he have to wait for the disciplinary charges to actually be served on his colleagues to think that there's a proceeding in hand?
There has to be some evidence of that at trial, Your Honor, or on summary judgment. You have to have something in the record.
Wait, then trial was not under at the time that Cuomo, and I'm going to put the gloss in light most favorable to plaintiff's mm-hmm. summary judgment, asked the plaintiff to destroy the document. Are you saying that Ventrella was not under investigation?
I believe that he was under investigation. The question is, did Schifolo, in connection with his CEPA claim, have a reasonable belief or knowledge? And he said he didn't.
Didn't he already know that Cuomo had been moved out suddenly in the middle of the day from right after he had spoken to him and then suddenly was no longer there?
Yes, Your Honor, he knew that.
Okay.
What's the reasonable inference to draw from the fact that plaintiff asked the question in the first place? He knew how to doctrack documents.
He did know how to doctrack documents, Your Honor, but that goes to, I guess, the second. He knew how to doctrack documents, and he also knew, because he had received, and it's in the record for you to look at, the memos that have the doctrack documents from the mm-hmm. other, it went to the field supervisor unit, and then it went, first it came into Colonel Fuente's office, and then it went to the field supervisor unit. This is both the letter and the memo.
Why do you think he asked the question?
I think he asked the question, Your Honor, because as the troop commander, all he had to do, as the troop sergeant major, he had to hand the document to Ventrella, who was gone. He was not the human resources person. This was already in human resources, the personnel file record. The memos were sent and doctracked. It went to human resources. It's simply when it goes to the troop, then the troop gives it to the state police officer, and he was no longer there. And that's why he was asking, what do I need to
do? Supposed to go to, well, I'm looking at the memo.
Yes.
The copy of this correspondence has been forwarded to HRMB for inclusion in his personnel file.
Right. That's HRMB. That's Human Resources Management Bureau. That's not also.
But his personnel, it was supposed to go into Ventrella's personnel file.
Right. It did go into Ventrella's personnel file, Your Honor, separate and apart. Troop B was just simply to give it to Ventrella.
Okay. So, like, why, this begs the question, why would, and assume all these facts to be true, why would Cuomo tell plaintiff to destroy the document? I mean, the answer to that plaintiff says is because the document is going to make the state police look really bad. The state police is investigating and later disciplining and firing Ventrella, and here is a document commending him for a job well done. I'm quoting from the correspondence. Mm-hmm. And then now they're telling, according to plaintiff, make this disappear. We don't want to see this at Ventrella's, you know, at disciplinary proceeding that the state police gave him an official well done.
Right.
That's his argument. And he says, I'm not destroying it. I'm not going to destroy that. He doesn't destroy it. Now he claims he's retaliated. Why isn't this a classic whistleblowing case?
Because with a classic whistleblowing case, Your Honor, you still have to identify, it's the state's position, whether, because the question here was, is it part of the prima facie case, and do you need to identify a rule, regulation, and connection?
Does he claim that he ever said, I'm not destroying the documents, or words to that effect?
I'm sorry, Your
Honor. Does the plaintiff claim that he ever said, whoa, I'm not destroying that document, or words to that effect?
He does. He claims that, I believe, at trial. I'm not sure on the summary judgment record, Your Honor. But in order to be a whistleblowing, it has to rise to the level of SEPA and what SEPA covers. And the question, the analysis that the court looks at when determining whether a case rises to the level of SEPA was set forth in Heitzman and Dwanar, which is when you object, as the state did, onto the objective reasonableness of whether a claim, you know, objective reasonableness as a matter of law, the court has to conduct a nexus analysis. So the court didn't conduct a nexus
analysis. So one of the reasons, I read the summary judgment transcript, and tell me if I'm mistaken about how the dialogue is going. The dialogue is not focusing on a criminal law that says that it's wrong to destroy an evidence. The state was arguing that Cuomo, look at all of the evidence. Cuomo really wasn't directing him to destroy anything. That was the focus of the summary judgment argument. Am I mistaken?
That is certainly a large part of the focus of the summary judgment, Your Honor. Also, but that goes
no
to
one was focusing on the law. And our case law, this Warner and Heitzman repeats this at least twice, is that the kind of conduct or law or policy can be identified by the court or the plaintiff, not just by the plaintiff. The court, obviously, is the master of the law and can recognize the law.
Right. So to that effect, Your Honor, Dwanar certainly says the trial court or plaintiff. I think Heitzman really just focuses on, says it's the plaintiff's obligation. But
no, I can, there are two places. Okay. In Dwanar, I can.
In Dwanar, absolutely.
Not Dwanar. In Heitzman, I have Heitzman before me, right? Where is it? So I'm going to quote from Heitzman because Heitzman is quoting from Dwanar. The trial court must determine whether there is a substantial nexus between the complaint of conduct and a clear mandate of public policy identified by the court or the plaintiff. By the court or the plaintiff. Heitzman says that twice. And of course, Heitzman isn't saying anything new. That's what Dwanar says. So, I mean, Heitzman is following our precedent. And of course, it's dealing with C3, not C2.
Dwanar, actually, Your Honor, dealt with all of C.
Okay.
That's the language.
Well, the language I just quoted is language in Heitzman and in Dwanar. Same.
Okay. To address that point, Your Honor, certainly Dwanar says that, and I think Heitzman is, when it's citing it, is saying this is what Dwanar said. Heitzman goes on and to cite the pivotal component of a SEPA claim is the plaintiff's identification of authority in one or more of the categories. Does a court have the ability to do additional research and make a determination on its own, separate and apart from what's identified from plaintiff, that a law has been violated? For example, it disagrees with plaintiff's cite to a law, but thinks there's another provision that applies. Can a court do that? Absolutely, Your Honor. The question here is just because a court can do it doesn't mean that that is only what, you know, the court should do. Amicus's argument seemed to be that plaintiff only has to identify facts, and that then it's the court's responsibility to, from there, divine everything else. And that is not, courts are neutral arbiters.
Is it your position that under the circumstances there was no objectively reasonable belief that 28-6 was violated, or that there wasn't adequate specificity or attention drawn to it by plaintiff?
Both, Your Honor. There wasn't adequate specificity drawn to it by plaintiff because it wasn't raised by either the plaintiff or the court on summary judgment or at trial.
And then
objectively reasonable basis is because the court has to conduct the nexus analysis. And when you look at the nexus analysis with respect to the specific provision, which is the 2C, which is this fourth degree crime, it says when you are aware. and there wasn't anything. You have to look at the record. Heitzman, what Heitzman said and the dissent disagreed with is you have to look at what is in evidence at the trial court at the time and what was before them. And plaintiff did not, either on summary judgment or at trial, say, I am aware that there is a pending investigation, I believe there is, and this is why this applies. And the court didn't conduct the relevant nexus analysis. Could perhaps if it had been identified.
Could you remind us what happened to Trooper Vitrella?
I'm sorry?
What happened to the trooper?
The trooper was ultimately transferred to a section, a different section, and then he voluntarily resigned at some point. So, oh, I'm sorry. I was getting confused. The trooper was terminated.
And that was the extent of the discipline? No further proceeding?
Not that I believe, Your Honor.
Now, the section you're talking about, C2, says fraudulent or criminal. Does your argument apply equally with regard to fraudulent? I mean, what has to be pointed to with such specificity as you're suggesting for the criminal part of that section for a reasonable belief that the plaintiff is saying he objected to on a fraudulent basis?
Right. So our position, Your Honor, is that you have to identify something, some standard, some written standard, just as the court held in Heitzman that with the clear mandate of public policy, there must be some written standard out there that applies. With respect to C2, a court can also look at that and say, okay, what is the, with respect to criminal, you can cite to the criminal code. With respect to fraudulent, the court, and I would just refer the court to the Melman decision, because I think it applies. The plaintiffs always cite to the Melman decision for the proposition that, you know, that CEPA is not meant to make lawyer or employers out of conscientious employees. But they never look at the previous provision section of that, which says, in our view, the sensible meaning of CEPA is that the objecting employee must have an objectively reasonable belief at the time of the objection or refusal to participate in the offensive activity, that such activity is either illegal, fraudulent, or harmful to the public health, safety, or welfare, and the critical operative term being the and, that there is a substantial likelihood that the questioned activity is incompatible with a constitutional, statutory, regulatory provision, etc. So even with fraud, there has to be something out there that plaintiff can cite to that says, this is fraud that rises to the level of CEPA.
He was saying destroy. So he wasn't citing the statute. But at least at the summary judgment motion, and tell me if I'm mistaken about this, the Deputy Attorney General wasn't arguing, cite me the law, cite me the statute, cite me the law. He was saying, look, he didn't tell him to destroy the evidence. They weren't fighting over this issue. And that's one of the reasons why I believe the trial court didn't bother identifying the specific law. He may have had it in his head. The judge may have known the criminal statute. He may have known the doctrine of spoliation. He may have known the regulation. He just didn't identify it because it was not at the heart of the debate at the summary judgment level. Am I wrong about this?
I would agree with Your Honor that it's not yes and no. I mean, the fact is, if you look at the briefing papers, as obviously you don't have, but the transcript before you, I believe it's page 5, in the transcript, the DAG does make a passing reference to the fact that the trial court has to do the analysis and has to identify that there's a rule, law, regulation that has been violated. Did he do it as cleanly, as argument, as we would have liked? No, but that
let me ask you about, just to give us the history of NJSA 2C28-61 in this case. Now, we see it not in the plaintiff's cert petition. We do see it in the amicus brief at pages 9 and 10. When did it make its first, when was it first cited by anybody in this case, as far as you know?
The criminal provision?
Criminal statute.
It wasn't cited until the amicus brief.
Until what?
Until the amicus brief,
Your Honor. That the law here, your contention is that the law that is now front and center in this argument as being the essentially the benchmark statute was never raised by the plaintiff at all.
Correct, Your Honor.
Only by the amicus.
Correct.
And there's no case out there that allows an amicus to substitute for either the plaintiff or the court in identifying a law.
I would agree with that, Your Honor. I think, as this court noted in Heitzman, that the trial court's additional, I think it's used the term post hoc, but additional search into the CDC wasn't regulations and decision to deny summary judgment as a basis for that, still didn't import to once there was a trial, because you have to look at the evidence that's before the jury at the time, and the fact that a CDC regulation was cited at the summary judgment still had no bearing on what happened before the court at trial, which is what was before this court was the jury instructions at the trial. So an amicus now citing what the relevant provisions are is post whatever evidence went in. And a defendant has to be able to defend itself and say that there's like a relevant, is there a relevant nexus or not to a particular rule, public policy.
I think the remedial purpose of SEPA is being furthered by insisting on technical citation of the correct portion of a criminal code when they're otherwise identifying the wrongful conduct that they believe is contrary to the criminal law of the state of New Jersey.
I think the remedial purpose of SEPA is being served by having it the whatever plaintiff is complaining about specifically identified. Melman says you don't have to identify it right at the stage when you go to complain. So we don't expect employees to be lawyers and say, you know, you were violating 2C3.3.
Right, that's ludicrous.
But right.
It is.
So, but once a complaint has been filed, once a plaintiff has an obligation to prove their case, the question is what type of information needs to be included in that and prima facie case.
And the purpose of that rule is to allow the defendant to understand what it is being accused of doing, correct? So that
correct,
it can defend maybe successfully, maybe not, but at least understand the nature of the violation of SEPA that it's being accused of committing.
Correct, Your Honor. To enable the defendant to at summary judgment or on a motion to dismiss to argue that there's no objectively reasonable basis and that you need the nexus analysis or once that nexus, let's say the court says there is a nexus analysis and it goes before the jury to still say that it's not a reasonable belief here because X, Y, and Z, so this rule doesn't apply.
So I know your reference to 5 and you're saying it could have been made better. The Deputy Attorney General does not press the issue other than making it factual. And then at the trial level, there is a charge to the jury. Was there any objection by the state to that charge, the part that I quoted?
No, Your Honor, there wasn't an objection.
So that seems to suggest that no one was thinking that the identification of the law was really an issue. The question was really the factual dispute. You're arguing the law now to us, and it's really finally honed. But it didn't seem to be a big deal at the trial level, but among anyone.
So, Your Honor, as a result of that, so it not being raised at the trial, the appellate division, well, I would say two things. First of all, the appellate division was focused on the summary judgment proceeding. And it's our position it was raised in the summary judgment proceeding. In the transcript that I cited to you, that the DAG does say you need to identify the relevant rule, law, regulation, etc. It admittedly was not honed more on a motion for reconsideration, nor was it done at the trial court. But the appellate court here was focused on, you know, what happened at the summary judgment stage, and did the court need to identify the rule regulation, or plaintiff need to identify the rule regulation, and that didn't happen.
So let me ask you this question. If the law, since the judge did not go into any great explanation as to why he was denying summary judgment, if the law was in his head, because he felt it wasn't, no one was really arguing the issue, but he was thinking that criminal statute, that spoliation, the spoliation of evidence doctrine, the regulations cited by the amicus, are we at this particular stage to overthrow the trial court's decision?
I think the
plaintiff loses because the judge could have been more specific in his reasons, even though we all know here, objectively, that this law exists?
I would answer that a couple of ways, Your Honor. Okay. First, I would say that there needs to be a reference to it in the trial, somewhere, for the court to do the nexus analysis.
And you've given a good argument for that, so that the opposing counsel can test whether there's a problem here, whether there's a particular statute. Tell us, when was that first raised? When did defendant first come forward in any proceeding and say, we need to know so that we can be certain what we're defending against?
It was raised.
You've given us the reference on summary judgment, but that's not
that's not clear enough. It probably was not raised until the appeal, Your Honor. And to that end, as Justice Alden pointed out, that it wasn't raised, you know, at trial, and there wasn't an objection. What I would say is then this court, the appellate division in this court, need to consider it under the plain error standard. And even when there's a plain error, where we think that the error could have impacted the jury, this court and the appellate division still have the ability to affirm the appellate division here.
But
and
you're saying your position is that by raising on summary judgment, if the defendant says it's the obligation of plaintiff simply repeating the law to identify the law, regulation, etc., statement of public policy, etc., that's all that the defendant has to do. In other words, court, reminder, plaintiff has the obligation to do this, impose that arguing that the court should impose that obligation on them.
At the summary judgment stage, yes, Your Honor. And then the ruling was the court looked at, and then on appeal we argued that summary judgment was improperly denied because the court hadn't done the relevant nexus analysis, and then the appellate division agreed.
Accepting that argument, I'm not asking you to abandon it. Tell us why you prevail under a plain error argument as well.
Because when you look under plain error, I wanted to cite the relevant case, Your Honor. Here, as with the plain error, and this is the State versus Macon case, that a plain error, an error will be found harmless unless there is a reasonable doubt that the error contributed to the verdict. And so the question is there a reasonable doubt that the error contributed to the verdict? We don't know because the court didn't. During the charge conference, the court did charge the jury and said, I find that the destruction of public documents is illegal. On what basis the court, like what exactly code the court was relying on mm-hmm. for that statement? The fact is,
can't we decide
that
as a matter of law now? We know, we can look at the statute. It's been read to us. We know the regulation. We know spoliation of evidence. We know that there are laws that say that you cannot destroy a document assuming the facts as given to us. Like, why would we ignore that at this stage under a plain error analysis?
I would argue, Your Honor, under a plain error analysis, because if the court was to cite in the jury instructions, I charge you that this is a violation, with a reason to believe this was a violation of Code 2C, which requires dot, 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 then the jury can make a determination as to whether they think that, you know, the facts they decide, and then does the law as the judge is charged.
Let me ask you
apply.
Why this could ever be plain error when it's not an affirmative defense. You know, if this were an affirmative defense that was required by the defendant, you tell me if I'm wrong about this, was required by the defendant to be raised and was waived, you would definitely be under plain error.
Right.
But tell me if I'm wrong. I thought that this is plaintiff's burden. It's a component of plaintiff's burden, and whether the defendant raises it articulately or doesn't raise it or whatever, it's part of the prima facie case that the plaintiff has to make, whether or not the defendant is in there insisting on it. Am I right about that?
I would agree with you, Your
So
Honor,
why would, even if it was inarticulately raised or argued, or even not even argued at all, why would this ever be under plain error, since the defendant has no obligation to wave the flag of SIPA's requirements at the plaintiff?
I would go back and say that, given your articulate analysis, it might not be that it needs to be analyzed under the plain error standard. We were looking at it from the perspective that it hadn't been raised, an objection to it wasn't raised during the charge conference, and that
that's the trial. So we've got no review of the trial.
Correct.
I totally agree that if there's that if somebody doesn't object to a charge, they're under plain error. But we're talking here about somebody coming in on a summary judgment motion, saying they're setting forth the requirements, and you mentioned what they did say on summary judgment. Why would it be plain error for even if the plaintiff, the defendant, did not articulately list off the requirements?
It wouldn't be plain error, and maybe I wasn't articulate enough.
So we're not talking about the charge. That might be plain error someday.
Plain error because we did object to it, even if not as articulately as other.
But you were asked to make a plain error argument, and I'd like to hear what it would be.
So the plain error argument would be if, not at the summary judgment stage, but at the trial, because we failed to object to the jury charge, does that somehow relieve plaintiff of the, and the court of the burden? And my response to the plain error argument would be that it's harmless, according to this court, unless it could have impacted the jury verdict. Here, the judge instructed the jury that, and I'm not going to deal with the falsification of evidence, but the other, the Setnar memo, the destruction of public documents, I am instructing you that it is illegal to destroy public records.
Right.
It's not technically true that it's not illegal. There might be situations where it is true. Mm-hmm. You need to analyze whatever the memo is. There's really
so it could have been important, and there may have been discrete jury findings relating to destruction of evidence versus destruction of other forms of official documents or not, that would have made a difference potentially in this case and your defense of it.
Correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
And a jury could have just taken that and said, oh, you can never get rid of documents based
right.
on that charge,
Got
which
it.
Is not the case.
Step aside from the facts of this case. Plaintiff has the burden. If plaintiff comes forward and alleges, I was asked to do something illegal, something that was criminal and doesn't specify beyond that, but what it is that plaintiff was asked to do was self-evidently criminal or fraudulent, do you need more to get beyond summary judgment? Suppose plaintiff had been asked to destroy narcotics that were in a vault. Would you still need specificity beyond the facts that were asserted?
I would say yes, Your Honor. You're going to. And the reason for that is that the self-evident is a subjective standard. Like, who determines whether it's self-evident? We can look at it and say, oh, well, that's bad. If it's so self-evident, if it's easy, the destruction of narcotics and all. There is a criminal charge that deals with that. You can cite to the code that deals with that. And the reason it's important, it's our position that it's important to do that, is because the court has to determine, the nexus analysis, a court has to determine whether the case rises to SIPA or is some
Well,
or
then
is
why is
level.
Two not redundant of one? If it's criminal, it's a violation of law.
Right.
They didn't repeat that language in C2. They made it an alternative theory.
They didn't cite that language in C3 either, Your Honor, and this court still held that with respect to the clear mandate of public policy.
Public policy is a lot mushier than a criminal law statute generally. I mean, public policy, I can understand why the legislature would be very careful, and we would be very careful about someone asserting their view of public policy. We're not talking about the same kinds of apples to apples here.
Not exactly, Your Honor, but I would say that in Heitzman, what this court looked at when it said that you still have to identify the rule, regulation, or public policy, it didn't alleviate with respect to the clear mandate of public policy, for example, the improper patient care. It didn't alleviate the obligation to cite to a rule or regulation. It didn't say, okay, only when you're relying upon a code of ethics, that's when you have to cite to.
But at the
relevant.
End of the day, tell me if I'm in Heitzman and in Zwonar, the court could no one identified a rule or regulation that was reasonably believed to be violated in both cases, correct?
Not true. I don't believe in Dwanar, Your Honor, they did cite, plaintiffs cited to the labor management regulations.
They did, but we found that that was not applicable. We found that no one had a reasonable belief.
Right.
This is different. We can identify, there are a statute staring us in the face. There's on all fours. There's a doctrine of spoliation. There's a regulation. These are things that we can see before us. Not, that wasn't true in Zwonar, where there is a supposed nexus. That wasn't true in Heitzman or even Zwonar.
True, but in Heitzman, Your Honor, the court still said that even when there's, you're citing to something like the court had done the CDC regulations, the majority still said when it comes to trial or even a summary judgment basis, you have to look at the evidence that's before the court, and they have to cite to stuff, and they didn't here.
If all that was required was that eventually on appeal you get very highly qualified amicus to come in, they identify a statute, you have appellate courts looking at it after the fact and then identify a statute, what kinds of problems would that cause for somebody trying to defend the case at trial before all of these illuminating events happen?
I think that says it, Your Honor, that how can a defendant be expected to defend themselves against whatever claim is being charged if they don't know, if the relevant rule regulation hasn't been identified for them to say, it doesn't apply here because, and let me tell you why.
But that's not the case here, because you did know. I mean, it was pretty clear that we were talking about destruction of evidence. So maybe in general that might be true, but it's certainly not true here.
Well, Your Honor, I would say that the destruction of evidence, we would say that it wasn't the only copy. And maybe this goes to the second part of once it gets past a nexus analysis, then you can argue argue objectively reasonable belief. But it wasn't the only copy of the document. In fact, it was already in the personnel files. There was three or four copies of not just the thank you letter, but the commendation memo certainly had gone from Colonel Fuentes to the field unit, to Setnar, and then from there to the troop. And it went to Troop C and then goes to Troop B, but is doc-tracked along the way. So there are existence, it's there. So to say the destruction of evidence, like if it was the only copy of a document, then certainly that would be more concerning than the fact that there are multiple.
But that wasn't the dialogue between the two. The dialogue between the two was it doesn't exist. And he read it, the plaintiff read that as I'm being told to destroy this document.
That's what plaintiff claims, Your Honor. Yes.
I just had a couple of quick questions. I had some trouble with the record understanding the document he thought he was being asked to destroy. Because when I first went through everything, I thought he was talking about the commendation letter from the citizen.
If you read the record, Your Honor, I think it varies over time. Initially, both at trial and then on the summary judgment.
Okay, well, let me go to trial and summary judgment. When's the first time anybody points to the memo from Setnar? That I was being asked
saying
to
that is what I was being asked to destroy.
And since that's potential evidence in this claim by Ventrella for wrongful discharge, that's the violation of law.
It's my understanding that if you look at the record, Your Honor, it's on closing at trial.
It's
that
on
they
trial?
Finally say
is on closing?
That closing at trial when plaintiff's counsel finally says, no, it's not the thank you letter, it's the commendation memo.
I have a couple more questions. I just want to get one thing clear for the record. So the first time the reference is that this memo asking me to destroy that would be the violation of law, because that's potential evidence in a potential proceeding by Ventrella for wrongful discharge or some other claim. Yes?
Yes,
because the letter from the citizen doesn't have any bearing. It's not the subject of an investigation. it's not the subject of a disciplinary proceeding. It couldn't be. Okay, so that mention on closing of the Centenar memo, who would have been this guy's supervisor, who would have been the one he said, I'm not destroying it to, that might have been a claim under the statute, 2C28.6, correct? That might have been.
It might have been.
But up till then,
and
but up till then, wasn't the evidence relied on, referred to, even in the motion for summary judgment, the letter from the citizen thanking them?
Correct. I mean, if you read the...
At what point was the memo letter from Colonel Fuentes the issue? When was that ever brought up as the issue? You're asking me to destroy that, not put it in the file, and that would be a violation of law. That would be criminal to destroy evidence, because that could have been evidence in a proceeding or an investigation. When was that first brought up? Ever?
Your Honor, there it's the record is a little.
I know
it, it moves, and so it's hard to completely identify. Does Schifolo say I was asked to destroy documents, or he didn't say that. He says I went in and I told the Cuomo I had these documents. What do I do with them? And then he says get rid of them. It's not clear from that exactly what he's talking about. Could he have been talking about everything, the whole packet? Yes. But it's not clear from the record that that's exactly what they mean. So I'm going to say that, again, it's on closing when it's clearly identified that that is what plaintiff claims.
But the Fuentes memo, the Centenar memo, and the letter were all in evidence by the time closing.
They were in evidence.
Okay. But is it your argument at least that the letter from the citizen, if he was asked to destroy that, that's not a violation of the statute because that's not evidence of anything. It would be the memos from the colonel and from the Centenar, from the...
To the extent that you were to say that the destruction of the Centenar memo and colonel memo rises to the 2C, that would be where? Not a letter saying thank you for escorting me down the highway.
And which one of those letters, there's three of them now. You got the citizen, you got Centenar, and you got Fuentes. Which one of those is DocuTrack? So that there's a record of what it is, where it is, and where it went.
So they're all DocuTrack.
So they're all computerized where it's going.
So when the thank you letter came in,
I don't need the whole thing.
Yes.
I just know which
yes,
ones are DocuTrack.
They are DocuTrack.
So, and by the way, Schiaffalo is the sergeant major in charge of making sure all the stuff's where it's supposed to go, DocuTrack properly. In other words, he knows how this stuff works.
Right. For when stuff comes to Troop B, he's responsible for
understood.
That.
Understood.
Yes.
He knows where it goes.
Yes.
So all three are docu-tracked, mm-hmm. right?
Correct.
And that's something Schiaffalo knows and understands.
Yes.
Were there extra copies, other copies, of all three of these documents?
They would be on the system.
What's that?
The docu-tracked. So when it's docu-tracked for where it goes, it would then go to the personnel file, as well as the files where it stayed with Centenar.
So the memo from the colonel, the memo from Centenar, and the letter are on the system.
Yes. Well, they're in the personnel record, or they're in the files of Centenar's office and everything.
Which one, where, and what?
Well, so that's where it comes
no,
to.
No, I'm asking.
When
you tell me. I couldn't figure it out.
Sure. When the document comes in to Colonel Fuentes, and it's the thank you letter, and then Colonel Fuentes sends the action memo to Centenar saying, please put this in and say it's a good job, or it says for assignment. When that comes in, it is doc-tracked by the Colonel Fuentes, secretary, someone, doc-tracks it, puts a document number on it, puts it in the file there, sends it on to Colonel Fuentes and HR.
And that's got all three.
Yes, and that's done each time.
Is there any way that destroying that piece, what do you want me to do with this, would have had any impact on the record of all three of those documents in the other places where it either be docu-tracked or filed?
Well, that's our argument, Honor, that it wouldn't have, and that's why it's not objectively
where was
reasonable
that argument?
In the second. That is before the appellate division
okay.
on the second prong. But that was also argued at below.
It was also argued that there were other copies, they were doctracked, therefore no one could reasonably believe this is the end of these documents.
All three documents. That's all I wanted to know.
I'm trying to understand. Are you saying that the Centnor recommendation letter was not referenced in the summary judgment record by the court?
No, it was referenced, but it didn't say at the time. The summary judgment argument is all about the, for the most part, the thank you letter coming in, and that's what he's being asked to destroy. And then at trial, argues it's all about the thank you letter until the closing.
Well,
it says best.
I mean, I'm looking at least the court, what the court said. The court, on May 2nd, 2012, Defendant Cuomo sent an email attaching the Ventrella. This was after, let me start at the beginning. April 30th, plaintiff presented the commendation letter to Defendant Cuomo. Defendant Cuomo told plaintiff that, quote, he would get in touch with Lieutenant Colonel Centnor and he would get back to him on it, end quote. Then on May 2nd, 2012, Defendant Cuomo sent an email attaching the Ventrella commendation letter to Lieutenant Colonels Edward Centnor and Acting Captain Thomas Mattia. Approximately a week later, plaintiff brought the matter to Defendant Cuomo's attention. Plaintiff asserts that the conversation with Defendant Cuomo went like this. I'm quoting, I went back in, I said, Major, I gave this to you last week, can you give me an answer on what we're going to do with this? And he said, it does not exist. And then it goes on with him saying, I said, I'm not going to get rid of it. And he said, didn't say much. That seems to me not to be referring to the citizen letter, but the commendation letter that was attached. Am I mistaken?
During summary judgment,
what I just read.
That's what the court said. The facts that the court is reading in, but the argument by plaintiff's counsel is about the thank you letter, and then at trial the argument was about the thank you letter, for the most part, until the end.
Okay, we've kept you up quite enough at this point. Anything else you'd like to add?
No, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. We'll take the matter under advisement.